Welcome to another episode of the RAG podcast. And for those of you who don't know, the RAG stands for Recruitment Agency Growth. Since early 2019, I've been interviewing the most successful and innovative recruitment owners to learn how they rose to the top of their game. In season 7, I'm going to be having raw, authentic, and insightful conversations with agency owners, entrepreneurs, leaders, people across the industry. And I want to be learning about their ambitions, what's happening behind the scenes in their agencies today, and their plans to navigate difficult market conditions. I'll be bringing you the latest and greatest recruitment stories every single week on Wednesdays at noon across multiple platforms. Stay tuned. Hello and welcome back to another episode of the RAG podcast. On this week's show, I'm joined by the founder of Heriot Brown, an in-house legal recruitment specialist recruitment agency with 14 people, headquartered in the UK, but the founder, Scott himself, lives out in Amsterdam now and is building out their European operation. On this show, we talk about how he started his recruitment business almost by accident. He was a legal professional for a number of years. He then joined the recruitment sector for a short period of time in his mindset. And within less than 2 years later, he's launched his own recruitment firm. 8 years later, he's now got a global business, a global brand. They've got their in-house podcast. They've got an event series that they run, and they genuinely built a community-first recruitment company. Some of the things they've come up with are incredible and a testament to the fact that Scott didn't actually spend much time in the recruitment sector. So what he doesn't know is almost his biggest strength. So if you're interested in finding out what a community-led recruitment business is, listen to this one. Without further ado, Scott, welcome to the RAG podcast.
Hi, Sean. Thanks for having me. Good to be here.
Pleasure, mate. Pleasure. It's been something we've spoken about a few times, and you said you've listened to the show for how long? Is it a few since the start or the last few years?
I don't know exactly when you started or when I did, but yeah, definitely a couple of years. Maybe back into lockdown when you were doing some different versions of it. So yeah, bit of a fanboy on here today.
Well, it's great to have you on board, mate. I went daily, if you remember, in the lockdown. I did. Started in 2019, weekly up until lockdown. Then I went daily, which was mental. Did 60 episodes in 60 days or something like that. And then went back to every week. I think I did twice a week again at the end in the second lockdown when we did it with an Australian group. But yeah, it's once a week's enough.
Yeah, I bet, yeah.
And you're coming to us from Amsterdam today.
I am, yeah. So I moved to Amsterdam last, it's about a year now since we uprooted from Southeast London and moved out here. So I'll, to set up our European office in Amsterdam. It's flown by, like a year out of London, bit of decompression from leaving the city of London. But back and forward. So I was back last week, meeting up with the guys in the team as well.
And you've got a lot going on personally at the moment as well. You've got the family, you've got kids coming. Well, you've already got kids, you've got more kids coming. You are a busy guy every time I speak to you.
It feels it, yeah. So we're, my wife's about a month away from due date. So that's baby number three. So we've got a six-year-old, a three-year-old, and this will be back to square one, just as it's felt like things are getting a bit easier. I'll be back into madness.
Mate, just before we started recording, I was in with the house with the baby and my wife, and she's like 5 months old, eating breakfast, like mashed apples. And I'm like, she's just perfect age. I was like, when is it going to get to the point where everyone says it's hard work? And Lauren was like, maybe 7-8 months yeah, when she's moved. And I was like, oh God, I just like it as it is. Yeah. Can we just keep it as it is now?
Yeah.
Perfect.
So they're all little chapters that you just have to find the enjoyment in each of them and as they progress. But how are the older kids with her?
Amazing. Yeah. They're like, they argue about who's holding her and the rest of it, but they're proper, like, yeah. I think they're at such a good age gap, 9 and 10 years older than her. I don't think they'll ever compete with her. I don't think they're going to be like they argue with each other all day, every day, yeah. but they're 18 months apart. But with the little one, they're like auntie and uncle type situation. Yeah. You know what I mean? So I'm thinking when she's 5, they'll be like 14, 15. They're going to be the babysitters. Oh, yeah. We'll be able to live our life. That's the plan.
Big time. We get babysitters. We get 12-year-olds and 13-year-old Dutch kids coming around to try flyer for babysitting. They've got a different mentality. Really? They'll leave their kids in 11-year-olds. They're in the house, looking after their siblings when the parents are out on the night and out to a restaurant.
Pretty chilled country, though, I believe, right?
I think there's a lot of similarities. There are stereotypes of the Dutch, which I'll not get into, but liberal society, but actually like quite a traditional country in many ways as well. So yeah. I think it's been quite an interesting learning curve because so close to home, and then doing business is slightly different. You have to tweak your approach slightly. And
what's the biggest, I mean, we'll get into the proper story in a minute, but like, what is the, I guess, number one cultural difference you'd say in the Netherlands?
Across business and across just personal life, like they're super direct and proud of it. Like there's meetings with Dutch clients or prospects that I've had, and they've obviously asked, like, how are you finding dealing with Dutch people, and they're like, we're really direct, aren't we? And it's great because you know where you stand. There's always an expectation that you're going to ask for something as well when you go to a meeting, which I think in the UK we tend to be around the bush and not jump straight into that. So that translates to like neighbors being like knocking on your door. If the kids are crying or our dog's barking in the garden, like they'll be around that day to tell you not to do it again. So they're pretty, they're straight out the blocks.
What are you supposed to do if your kids are crying though? Just like,
mate, our neighbor, like honestly, last year when we got here, it pissed it down for the first month and a half to 2 months that we were here. There wasn't a day that you'd have had the back door open. Springtime sort of came around, and I think we had breakfast out one morning in the garden at about 8:30, and then I was working from home, got a knock at the door. We've got an intercom, so it was downstairs. It's a neighbor moaning about Aaron, our son, screaming with the back door open. And then he came back at night, did the same whilst I was putting the kids to bed on bed duty. And just like, don't let them out in the garden before, don't open your windows before 9:30. I was like, that's an interesting time. But
he gave you that advice, like, do us a favor, don't let them out.
He was just moaning. He's notorious, I think, amongst them. Now we've made friends with some of the other neighbors, him in particular, he's very very direct and a bit of a grump, but we turn a blind eye a little bit.
You can't shut, if your kids are gonna cry, they're gonna cry, but yeah, shut
the window. Type of thing in the UK you would probably list your house and sell your house before going round to your neighbors and telling them to shut their kids up.
You would. I mean, my neighbors are they're turning their 4-bedroom into a 7-bedroom house, right? They've ripped everything apart. I had this brand new garden built, brand new fence put up. Within a week of their building started, my fence was flat because they took all the foundations out. It was carnage. But we get on, so we've spoke about it, and it's been fine. if they were fine when I did my work last year, so I've been fine with it. It's kind of like we've got a really nice mutual agreement.
Yeah.
Well, and my wife's like, are you going to have a go at them about that fence? And I'm like, well, not really. No, I'm just going to talk to them. Like, of course they're going to put it back. Yeah. They better do. And they have, they've done it fine, but we are just polite, I think, rather than go around and God, I don't know if I could handle a neighbour like that, especially with kids. I'd be a bit like,
it's different. We'll just adjust our approach, but
manage your expectations, treat them like a client.
Yeah, exactly. Always difficult clients. Exactly.
So let's get into the business side, Scott. You obviously own Harriet Brown. I've just mentioned it a brief amount in the introduction. So do us a favor, tell us what it is you actually do on a high level.
Yeah.
Like the people, locations, that kind of stuff. And then we'll go back and tell how you've got to where you are.
Yeah. So I'm founder of Harriet Brown Legal Recruitment. So we're a specialist within the legal space, and we focus on recruiting lawyers in-house, so into corporates rather than, so a lawyer will work either, generally speaking, in a law firm, so that's what's called private practice, where they're effectively on agency side working with numerous clients, or they'll work for a corporate or a financial institution or a government body. And we supply lawyers on both a permanent and an interim basis into the in-house space. We operate across, so we founded the business in the UK. We have 14 employees at this point in time. And yeah, like UK, but we cover EMEA. So I've, as I mentioned, I've moved to Amsterdam to grow our European operations, and we've recently launched service and working with clients in the US. So that's part of the expansion plan.
Wow. There's a lot going on. And you started life as a solicitor and a lawyer yourself.
Yeah, I did. So I'm depending on who I'm talking to, I'm a recovering lawyer. So I'd listened to your guest a few episodes ago, who was in a similar position and had moved into recruitment. And it's not uncommon, I think, for legal recruiters anyway, to have at least a background in law, whether it's studying or have actually gone through and qualified. But yeah, I don't know how much of the backstory you want on.
What was it? I guess what was the reason you didn't stay as a lawyer?
I could go quite far back on that. I think I never really felt at home being a lawyer, and then it's a lot of that's with hindsight, right? But like studying, it's a vocational part. It's partly a vocational degree. So you go to university. I had no background or family history working in the legal profession. So when my history teacher at school said, "You're quite good at writing and analytical thinking, don't do history because you'll become a history teacher. Go and study law." That's what I did. And you enjoy. It's a 4-year degree in Edinburgh. I studied at Edinburgh. It's a 4-year degree in Scotland, and you do like your first 2 years, like any degree, sort of mixing around. You're undergrad. I did a year abroad in Germany, and then straight back. That my whole honours was based on my fourth year, and you get into a bit of a conveyor belt because the majority of people that are studying that law degree are going to go on to be a lawyer. I think it's about 70% that go down that career path. So I never really invested the time at that point in time to step back and go, actually, what do I enjoy? Didn't really know what being a lawyer actually entailed and what the day to day looked like, because I didn't really have any exposure to it. And then landed on my feet and got a training contract, which is effectively like the holy grail, quite hard to come by.
It's called the LPC, right?
The LPC is another step. So would you believe it? I gave up being a lawyer, having done this amount of studying, and people thinking, are you actually mad? The length of time that you put in to studying. So you do another, that's your practical year, your LPC in Scotland. It's called the legal diploma, it's the equivalent. Then you do a 2-year training contract with a firm where you get paid graduate level salaries, and then you're qualified, right? So you've done the best part of 7 or 8 years just to get to that point. And I always thought, oh, that'll be brilliant. I'll be a qualified lawyer. The world will be my oyster. I can do whatever I want. And it was all round about the financial crisis. So it was 2008, I started my training contract. And to be honest, I was just delighted that law firms or the firm I was at hadn't cancelled their training intake for the year, which some of the competition had done. And then on qualification, got offered a role in the corporate team. So that's like buying and selling companies, actually like quite interesting work. See, like, think if you think of suits and the romantic version of the legal profession, then it's nowhere near it, but it's probably like in boardrooms at times, but never really found my groove. Like, didn't feel that comfortable, always looking at other people, like friends that were even in other corporate jobs, and thinking, oh, that just looks, sounds better, like they seem more fulfilled in the job and the career that they're doing.
What did you spend your time doing? Just reading contracts and things and just checking?
You're basically there. So a company's selling, could be the owners of a business selling to another, to a company that's acquiring them. and you're doing like due diligence on that business, so looking at old contracts, try to find like things that will basically affect the price that the company's actually paying, or affect the warranties as to who's covering anything. Like, but as a junior, you're just that far removed from the actual like detail on the deal. Like, you don't really see what's going on. You're very little client exposure. You're just looking at one aspect of the transaction, and a lot of document review and.
I think that'd kill me.
Yeah,
it would be my worst nightmare.
Detail, a lot of detail, or attention to detail is the big point there, and I think that's probably what killed me.
I just don't think, like, even now, I think, you know, I've had to build a training academy, and I've done all this documentation. I create monthly slides that we run on free workshops, and I'm always producing documentation. It's still my worst. I'll leave it till the last, not the last minute, but I'll put it off as far as I can, because right. I'll always gravitate to picking up the phone or jumping on a call or being on Zoom or sit me in front of a document. And I'm like, producing content, strangely, is something I enjoy doing. It's like, it's just one area that I don't mind doing, but everything else, I don't know. I guess that's why I gravitated to recruitment. Even as a teacher, I was at the same time as you were doing that, I was doing my training teacher stuff.
Yeah.
And yeah, it was too much paperwork, too many slides, too many, you know, presentations to plan. Even in PE, you're still planning a lot. Documentation, I was like, oh, it's just not, I don't know, it just didn't work.
Yeah. How do you knuckle down if you are, when that deadline's coming, how do you do it?
Do you know what I've said? I thought I've said this before. I actually used to think it was like a weakness of mine, that I would leave things to the latest possible time where I could give myself enough time to do it. Mm-hmm. Now I think it's like a strength. That, like, I'm literally, let's say something's due on the 1st of April, and I'll mentally work out how much time I think I need. I'll give myself that time and maybe 10% before, and then I will literally do it. Like, I've never missed a deadline. I will always make the deadline. And I know that looking at my whole life, I've always, if I'm going to do something, I'll do it. But there's no point in me stressing about something that's 2 months away. Like, I literally just push it away. My team are like, you know, we've got that event coming up, or we've got this coming up. I'm like, talk to me about it when it's critical. I ain't got the headspace or the interest in it. I can't get myself into the mindset for it. So what was the trigger point for you to get into recruitment then? Because you, was it Taylor Root was the first recruitment job you took?
Yeah. So
2014.
Yeah. So I'd gone quite far into being like, given it a good bash, being a lawyer. We moved to Australia, worked in Sydney in a firm there, and That was a move firms to a different even by the beach, it didn't make things a hell of a lot better as a lawyer. Place that I'd always wanted to live, and enjoyed the lifestyle, but it was still just the day to day not doing it for me. So I'd been looking, when we were out there, I was looking for a while to get into, I always looked at, like, the partners in a law firm, they're subject matter experts, they've worked their way up, and that's where the sort of key relationships with clients sit. And I think in any business, like, the people that add the most value and that are effectively indispensable to that company are those that have the relationships. As a junior lawyer, you're in a law firm, you are monetized by billable hour. So the law firm does work and charges the client by the billable hour. So every hour that you work on a client's matter, that's going out the door at £300-400 an hour, if you're any good. And then I always looked at that would be an interesting position to get to, but haven't to learn and go through 15 years of the detail to get there didn't appeal. So the business structure within a law firm was always something that I was a little bit at odds with, because I think you can sell without necessarily knowing that level of detail. But I'd looked at sales positions in Australia, again, was just like looking at a whole host of different things. At the time, there was a massive opening up of the legal sector, so a big change. There was a deregulation at the SRA, and to be honest, a bit of a global switch that you could own a law firm without being a lawyer. And there was a lot of legal tech and technology in that industry. So to be honest, that was the step that I wanted to take. I wanted to move into a sales role within this disruptive space. So there's a couple of companies, Axiom and Lawyers on Demand. Our move back, sorry, this is a long-winded answer to your question, but our move back to Australia, my mum wasn't well at the time, so wanted to be back closer to home. It's a hell of a long way away when you're when something like that happens. So back to London, and I did a recce for a week of, I mean, this was probably my first taste of business development. I hammered every single legal tech provider that I could find in London or alternative business structure within the legal space, and approached them about sales jobs or headquarter roles within their businesses, and did a almost like an interview roadshow. There's no jobs advertised at the places, but met with a lot of people in that space. Feedback was, you don't have a network in London and you've got no sales experience. But like, if you get that, then give us a shout in a year's time. So ultimately, like everyone, I think the majority of people I speak to fell into recruitment. I thought, I'm going to get a job in recruitment. I'll build up my network of general counsels in London. And that was who the target market for these companies were. And then in a year's time, I'll leapfrog into one of these businesses. But yeah, joined Taylor Root, which is part of the SR group. And loved it. Loved the hustle. Loved the, like, felt totally.
Did you have to take a pay cut to go there?
Oh yeah, yeah. But I'd really got to the point, like, leaving Australia. I promised myself. So we moved to London. My wife now transferred back with the firm she was at in Australia.
She was working as a lawyer as well.
Yeah, she's a lawyer. Yeah.
She was happy with it.
She's still a lawyer. She's happy with it. She's in house. She works in she works in the retail space. She's very different in many ways to what she enjoys in her work.
What was that like though, in terms of like being in a relationship now, married to a fellow lawyer? You're really struggling with it. She's kind of enjoying it. Like, was that a big topic of conversation in your personal life as well then? Like, you can't really escape it if that is what...
Do you know, it was more of a topic when I was a lawyer. Like, I remember just being like you spend so much time in at work, and the amount of those days where I just would go home and be like, I felt like I had no context of what it was that I was doing, and treading water, particularly those few years in Australia, I didn't feel like I was making any progress, and I could see her like absolutely smashing it in the firm that she was at, and it would have more of an impact at that point in time that I would just be constantly whinging about what I wanted to do. And to be honest, it was her saying like, you need to do something else because this is killing you doing this. It's just not giving you any joy. And clearly talk about
what was the role you went in to do then? Was it like did they give you like a different title or anything with your experience? Like, how did they treat you? Because you're not going in as like a graduate, are you? You're going in as you've been a lawyer for a number of years.
They give you the title of consultant, so you're going in. There may have been a slightly different base salary, but I mean, I was still taking at least a 50% or more than 50% cut on base salary. And that's the thing. Like, I say this now, to even the guys in the team, I don't take it lightly. Like, very fortunate personal circumstances to have a wife and partner that was in a position that I could take risks like that and calculated risks and pay rent. So it's not lost. That's not lost on me. But yeah, it was going like, again, at SR Group at Taylor Root, there's quite a lot of people who have been ex-lawyers that make that switch. And I think they still recruit that sort of profile now. So they didn't treat you any differently. I was into a warm desk in the in-house team there, which was a team of about, I don't know at the time, maybe about 16 split between financial services and commerce and industry. So I was on their heavy industries desk. I'd done, which was energy and renewables, construction.
Yeah.
I'd worked when I was in Australia, it was mining and energy clients that I'd worked with. So it was quite a nice fit.
How quickly did you take to it?
Be interested to hear their take. It felt like anyone, I think nervous first while, just getting on the phone. I'd imagine similar to any grad, like going in and picking up the phone. It's a completely different job, and you're selling. And I don't think, I think being a lawyer gives you something. I don't think it doesn't make you a good legal recruiter at all. It's a sales job, and totally flips your day on its head compared to what I was doing previously. My brother has a recruitment business. He's a recruitment business owner in Scotland. I had some experience working there during summers at university. So it wasn't brand new, but got the industry and have seen his approach was just slightly different to mine, but yeah, it wasn't completely green.
What was the training like you were provided by Taylor Roof? They're a big company, aren't they? Like, they've got a number of brands and
I don't know how many brands they have now, but yeah, Taylor Roof's one of the bigger. They had an internal L&D team, but it was predominantly on desk, like just learning. And there's, like I said, there's somebody I think had left in that team, and I was inheriting that heavy industries desk. So it was like, there's the phone, there's a list of candidates, list of clients that we've worked with in the past, crack on. And then light touch points on the beyond systems and database training. There was L&D training, like learning and development training spread throughout.
So obviously, you know, you come in, you've got a couple of years experience as a lawyer, you're not a graduate, you've come into this business. And then less than 2 years later, you leave to start your own.
Yeah.
So talk me through that, because that's quite bold. Like, that's not a common thing I've come across on this show. And I've interviewed a lot of people on this show. You know, there's the odd one. Yeah. So how did that all evolve?
So like I said, I hadn't gone there thinking I was going to be there forever. I had almost gone there with the approach that I was going to jump to one of these businesses after a year, right? And when I joined, like Axiom, Lawyers on Demand, these businesses, they were marketed. What I then found, they're effectively doing labor supply, but on a temporary basis to in-house legal teams, and just marketing themselves very well, like really modern approach to marketing. Taylor Root and every other agency was doing temp contract supply. So the scales sort of fell off my eyes when I looked at those companies from a bit of a different angle. And I was like, they're not doing that much different. It's not like they're changing. They're not reinventing the wheel completely. And I'd always wanted to, I think in my head, I'd always wanted to run my own business and have my own business. Whether it be recruitment or doing this sort of legal tech side, I just didn't have the idea as to what that would look like and when it would happen.
Yeah.
And then it would have been probably less than a year into being at Taylor Root, I got a phone call, like a headhunt phone call from the managing director of a construction business. And they were doing like claims, right? So they're a big quantity surveying business. They do claims in the construction sector. And they had got one of these licenses to set up a law firm that was attached to their claims business. And they wanted to hire lawyers to come and service the work that they could feed into this law firm. And I went and met them for a coffee, and I was like,
what are you going to do? Were you the internal recruiter they wanted to
hire? They wanted to hire me as an internal, yeah. And I had been recommended. I met this guy really recently, a guy, Michael Page, who had passed the managing director my name. And I met him for a coffee and thanked him and owe him a few beers. Yeah, just in that meeting, I was like, I don't think you're going to need me after a year. Like, once you've hired a couple of these partners, you're going to jog me on and I'm not going to have a job. You could offer me all the money you want in the world, yeah, but I could probably be here for 6 months and then get pushed away. Yeah. So, but I was like, what I'll do is I'll set up my own recruitment business, pay me a retainer, like a monthly retainer. I'll get you what you need and we'll revisit it after 12 months. But I can, other than the construction sector, I can go after everything else in the in-house space. But obviously for the first period of time, I'm going to be very focused on earning that retainer. And to my like absolute shock, they said yes. And it then took a good few months to draw up this contract that would, I tried to make it as belt and braces as possible, that I would have this retainer for some period of time. But gave me the, just going through that negotiation process, like I learned so yeah. much going through that, just being ballsy enough to say, this is how I could see it working. And yeah, like I still, when I handed my notice in, when I set up the business, it was all a bit rushed.
How did the business take it? How did they take it, Taylor?
All right. I think a bit shocked. So Julian, who was the head of their in-house team at that point in time, who was a partner, just told him, and he was like, "You feeling all right? You've been doing this for about 5 minutes." And yeah, felt a little bit like laughed a little bit, but and then by that point, I was dual desking. What I didn't like actually about that, and great business, private equity owned, and I could never see myself working through that corporate ladder. And that's even clearer with hindsight and having the confidence now as a business owner. But like they'd split my desk after being there for about 8 months and doing quite well, which was fine. But they dragged the guy in that they thought we were going out together to set up, but he hadn't shared the information with him. So told him in the room, and I think they were looking for what the reaction would be like. But yeah, all good. Just got standard and marched out the door.
What was the value of the retainer you signed that gave you that cushion?
It was significantly more than my base salary at Taylor Root. So it was about 7K a month.
It's not bad, is it?
Not bad for your first invoice. I was still worried that they weren't going to pay it when it went out the door, thinking, is this for real? Is this going to happen? So, and yeah, like drawing up your first invoice and like sticking.
Did that mean though you were locked in to just work for them and you couldn't do any other recruitment, or could you go and build a client base on the side?
Yeah, so I went and built a client base on the side. So basically, ring fenced construction. So any construction lawyer, like it's quite a specific area in construction. Yeah. Clients, so I didn't. I was restricted from building that at the outset. But yeah, like I said, for the first good few months, got them what they needed, to be honest, and it was a very good relationship. And continued working with them as the retainer fell away after 12 months.
Yeah.
But. Continued working with them for a period of time. I think we're still in touch, but yeah, it worked out really well. And then,
where's the name come from? Where's Harriet Brown from? Obviously, Brown's your surname.
Yeah, Brown's my surname. So, but like I said, there it was a bit rushed, to be honest. And like actually, business plan. Like I've heard all your guests and of different backgrounds talking about the groundwork going in and setting things up and putting everything in place. That didn't really happen for me, partly because I was finding my feet as I went along. Harriet Brown, so I stayed on, there's a street in Edinburgh called Harriet Row, which I really like, and I stayed close to that when I was at uni, and yeah, a bit aspirational on that front. So Harriet Brown, a lot, again, the legal professions, it's relatively traditional.
Yeah. So it was, yeah, yeah. It was Yeah, there's that classic two-word, two surnames kind of law firm type feeling about it.
didn't have any Hoxo sort of inspiration around that. How did that come about?
It's funny though. So Hoxo, we had two businesses at the beginning. We had Hoxo and we had one called Anderson Choan, which I've never really spoken about. But Anderson Choan was a mini recruitment company that we had going in the first, so the first year, we just needed to make money, right? So we had Hoxo doing the branding stuff, the social media. And then we had Anderson Choan was our little mini recruitment firm. We didn't have a website. We literally just filled jobs for people we knew in the first year. We got about five runners out. That just ticks us over for the first year. Hoxo was a name that it took ages to come up with. We bought about 1,000 domains. I knew I wanted a made-up name. I knew I wanted it to be one word. Media. We're trying to drop the media now, but it's just kind of stuck to us. And we came up with Noxo was the word, N-O-X-O. Right. Noxon was the first one, N-O-X-O-N. And then that was already taken. So then Noxo, and then my brother Googled it, and In the urban dictionary, a Noxo is a homosexual mammal.
Right.
And not that I'm homophobic, but my brother just said, "You sure you want this as your starting point?" And and then we literally just tried to change the first letter.
Right.
Loxo, which is now a tech CRM in the space, was one of the ones we looked at. But Hoxo, I think we liked Hoxton as an area, but that wasn't anything. It wasn't an inspiration. It was more of a we like that, and it sounds similar, and it'll do. And it felt right. As soon as we said it, it was like,
It's got a good ring.
Right. Yeah, I think so. I'm interrupting today's episode to give you a message from our brand new sponsor. Now, this company are called Untapped, and everyone knows that Hoxo, through this podcast, I've explained that we've built our team internationally, heavily in South Africa, okay? And I get questions all the time from clients and people who listen to the show, like, how have you done it? What was the process, etc.? Well, I've partnered with a business that can ultimately reveal it all, share it all, and help you do the same, right? Because look, it's been a tricky year for the sector, and many of people through uncertain times have had to streamline operations. However, you know, accessing low-cost resources internationally has proven to be a bit of a cheat code for some people, including Hoxo. But anyone who's tried it, like us, it's very difficult, a lot of work, process to get it right. So this company, Untapped, are one of the hottest companies in the market. They've helped Hoxo, they're helping our clients. And they specifically look at companies in the UK, US, Middle East, and Australia transition to using remote individuals and building full offshore sourcing and recruitment solutions. So they source talent pools from places like South Africa and the Philippines. And we're talking about experienced talent here. We're not talking about graduates with no experience. This is like people with 3 to 5 years recruitment experience, and integrate them into your UK team, okay? So they work remotely, but plug into your UK team. They put around 3,000 candidates per month through an intense 4-stage interview and online testing process to find the top 1%. Or 30 people and secure these people for work with recruitment agencies like yourself. You know, all candidates are benchmarked against UK competency frameworks and the way in which you would hire in the UK. So we're not talking about cheap for the sake of being cheap. We're talking about international experienced people just living in lower cost locations. So it's a really simple process if you want to work with these guys. You pay a deposit to kick off their search. They then provide a candidate shortlist in 14 days. And then you can put people through your own process to hire them permanently, or there's a freelance option. So if you just want to try before you buy, they can employ them. You pay a daily rate and it's a freelance option. Untapped are totally transparent with all the salaries and fees. But, you know, we're talking about you'll still pay about 70% less than a UK equivalent in that role. So it's a no-brainer to complement your existing team to handle surplus demand and ease cost pressures. You know, if you're not using this to rip up your business and rebuild it with global resources, then you're probably gonna fall behind eventually. So due to demand and capacity, they're only operating on a waiting list right now. So if you wanna be part of their waiting list, go to www.tryuntapped.com. Okay, www.tryuntapped.com and check out their information. Make sure you say that you listen to the RAG podcast, because they'll do you a very special deal as well. Right. Go and check them out. Back to the show. So where did you start the business? Were you working at home? Like, how did you set it all? Because you got this retainer, which not many people have. Yeah. You've got cash flow from day one. Mm-hmm. How did you invest it, and where did you spend your time?
Yeah. I spent my time in, so for the first, I don't know how many months, it's one of those that I'm like looking at milestones and anniversaries and things. I'm like, fuck, I don't think I've got a photo of me at my desk in the house, sat at the kitchen table, the classic sort of founder photo. As we did an annual sort of retreat with the team in January. And then moved into a WeWork at Old Street. So went into the WeWork there and took a fixed desk in there after getting a bit cabin fever working in the house. And stayed at that point, lived in Haggerston in London. So it was a stone's throw.
Obviously, looking at your background, so the lawyer knowledge, get it. Moving into Taylor Root makes sense. Didn't become, you know, a household name and stay there for 10 years and build their whole function. You left really quite early. Mm-hmm. I completely understand why. And I think there's probably the best reason to start is sometimes, why not? Someone phoned you. But I guess you probably hadn't developed some of the skill sets that you would associate with a founder at the beginning. So then, without going through every year, you've been running over 8 years now. So if we look at the first few years, how was the business running and what were you learning on the job? Because you didn't know necessarily, you'd not run a big team or ran a recruitment firm. So what were those first few years like and how did you run the business?
Good question. So I would say very like learning as you go. And I reflecting on it now, there's loads of mistakes made along the way, and a lot of them I probably wouldn't change if I went back and did them, because you go through that. But it was all about client acquisition and celebrating like small wins. Like for me, the big thing about owning my own business was to like have financial autonomy and be independent. I don't like reporting into someone. I didn't like it, and again reflecting on it, I just couldn't do it. I wasn't excited by that management progression, but yeah, I hired again without the I didn't have a blueprint, didn't have an agency blueprint. It was as to what it would look like, the markets that we were going to cover, everything like that has been built like around billing. So it was very much me on delivery, obviously on the tools and servicing that one particular client, keep that revenue coming in, and then getting our name out and like, yeah, cold calling, getting our brand out there. Hired a guy called Andrew Murray, who joined us or joined me. He called me. I'd spoken to him when I was at Taylor Root as he was a candidate. He was a lawyer and he had moved in house and he was getting made redundant, and he phoned me to ask me if I had any jobs, and I didn't in the space that he was in. I was like, come in there. I think he did stand-up comedy, that's what he did, and I remember meeting him and he was sound guy, and keep in touch with him to today. But he was like, my friends have always thought I could maybe get into recruitment or sales. Like, what do you think? I was like, come and give it a bash. Come, if the worst case scenario is you find yourself a new job whilst you're here. So he came and trialed it out for about 6 weeks, and whilst he was still interviewing for legal jobs to see if he fancied it. And then he did. So at that point, it was very much feeding him work, because again, we were both sort of learning as we went. And then over the next few years, it was very much organic growth. So two hires, Kevin, who's still with me, Sam, who's still in legal recruitment, but he left us shortly after lockdown. But they were referrals from HR contacts that I had within the energy space. So they came on board, and then lockdown.
What were those mistakes you said? A few standout ones. Like, what did you do wrong in those early days that you look back and think, bloody hell?
To be honest, I think commission structure and like setting expectations around that for those early starters. So not really having a firm grasp on A, what the value of the business was, what the value of the work I was doing in order to generate that business and like the hard yards. I think at that point in time, small business, you're like honored that someone's coming, almost you feel a bit honored
that
someone's
that.
Coming yeah. with you on the journey and to like backing you, right? So so that structure, putting that in place, which was overly generous, and then having like almost try to backtrack on it, it's never going to go down well, never going to be a recipe for success. Not having a structure, not that we necessarily needed it, and I think not having foundations in like everyone being 360 and having a training plan for how to get from zero experience or whatever someone's coming in at and being a 360 recruiter. So that really slowed things down in the first few years, or those, I guess, straight out of like really early days into
I guess career. At that point though, you probably weren't thinking, you may have, it sounds like you weren't thinking too far down the line anyway. It was about, right, maybe the next 3 to 6 months ahead and just make money and keep living for yourself and not have to get a job.
Yeah, exactly. You're just fucking loving the fact that you're doing your own thing. Like you look back on it now and it's so much simpler when it's like that as well. Life at that point in time was a hell of a lot simpler without kids and not married and no house and all these things that definitely skew how you approach things. There was no need to at that point in time. And I didn't have, like I said, I didn't have a plan. I didn't know what good looks like. I didn't, which is a weakness as well as I see it as a strength as well. You don't necessarily, you can think outside the box. And I think that's, I'm not great at giving myself compliments, but I do think that's like one of my key strengths. I don't necessarily have to follow this track.
So when did you start thinking more about the business as a business and, like you say, putting in more of a process and procedure for things and thinking about how am I going to get this guy or girl to find their own jobs and like become a bit more than just like enjoying?
Yeah, so in lockdown, so going into like March, so the start of that year, 2019, end of 2019, Andrew, the guy that had been with me for about 3 years, he decided to move into exec search. So him leaving was a bit of a tipping point. We backfilled early January and then went straight into lockdown in March. And it was probably halfway through that year or towards the end of that year that like really instilling a 360 mindset, looking at like what's our why, what is it that we do, key market focus, and how we're gonna grow. And I worked with one of my good friends from university's ex, Hayes and Skills Alliance. So he was chief operating or CCO at Skills Alliance and grew that business. He was in between Skills Alliance and setting up for himself. So I worked with him like as on a consultancy basis just to build a framework and look at sort of training the team and helping around that. So that was probably the big tipping point in switching that mindset from being kind of 180, 270 to like how we're growing this through 360 recruiters.
And what is the reason you want 360 recruiters?
Because it felt unscalable. Our business is we're aligned on sectors, so like candidates become clients, clients become candidates. You can do it. You can do it 180, but it's a lot easier to do it on that basis that you can give and receive, and those market insights are really important to the sectors that we cover. So that's the, and we're not the majority of the work we do is exclusive. We're like line relationships, like very very few things are created and originated through talent acquisition teams because it's quite niche. So those are we miss out more than what we gain from being 180.
Yeah, that makes sense. There's obviously two ways of looking at it, and I always worked in a 360 model. I've built a business. It's not a recruitment business, but it's more of a 180 business. Right. And I've got a new business team, and I've got a delivery team, and I can see the pros and cons in both. I think when you're small and you're lean, I think it makes more sense to have people doing the full job, because you, and then you can decide later when you've got a bit of size whether or not you want to then slice and dice roles, or you just want to keep going the way you are. When did you start looking at the business, you know, and thinking about where you were going to be and building, because you've invested in a podcast, you've been working with us on your brand for the last year. You know, your business is actually very, I think you think a lot more of a modern way than a lot of people. When did it suddenly become, right, we're gonna, is it post pandemic, you're like, right, we are gonna change? And like, obviously you've left London, there's so many things you've done to move this business on. Talk us through that post pandemic journey, I suppose.
A lot of that is, again, it's like feeling, if it feels right, I tend to do it. If someone else isn't doing it, then I'll try and do it and figure it out. Luxury there was moving to that 360, and that was the first step in enabling me to step back from every relationship and been responsible for everything. We then hired, like, the pandemic was, like, I think a lot of agencies quite like pivotal and make or break. Absolutely shitting myself for about 3 months at the start of it, and then but just jumping on it. So didn't furlough anyone. There was only four of us, but didn't furlough. We were very lucky with some of the clients that we worked with in the tech space that were still hiring at mass, and just went online, everything. So did round tables, like really bought into the community and the marketing piece, and spoke to people that were never going to be able to help at that point in time. And like when everyone else was furloughing people. So then we picked up actually a few amazing recruiters who are still with us. So Lucy and Mitchie, just towards the end of 2020. And then steadily, again, fairly organic growth, with a bit more structure in terms of the sectors that we were going, but lack of structure on layers of management and how are we gonna grow and scale once we've got people that are experienced hire. So that was always my leaning, was towards people that had experience.
When it comes to marketing though, and investing in, like you say, a podcast and people's personal brands, like why did you make that decision?
So it was from out of lockdown, from the value that you get from giving value to people. But part of it was having been a junior lawyer and not really knowing anything about, feeling lost in the profession, not really inspired by, and no disrespect to anyone that I worked with, loved everyone that I worked with, and the relationships were great within the firms that I worked, but I didn't go, that's the job I want. So to give a voice to people that are doing really well in the profession and that can give that voice. And it's a door opener, it's a conversation starter. So from a sales perspective and a marketing perspective, any of those conversations, you're not talking about recruitment, but you're presenting yourself and you're credible and adding value and thought leadership. So that was the thought process behind it. And again,
was it something anyone recommended to you though? Or did you just, like you say, you're watching what I'm doing and other people, and you think I could do this myself?
Could do that, yeah. I think no one recommended it. I think like it's the way I would consume content. Like it's my chosen chosen way of consuming things. And the thing that would stop me was thinking, who's going to listen to this, and why would anyone listen to this? Or my friends absolutely slaughtering me for thinking that I could have a that I could have a podcast. But that hasn't stopped. But that was the thought process behind it. I don't know if you're looking for something more.
No, I think that's exactly it. I like the way you said it earlier though, like you kind of go off a feeling, like it feels right. And you've obviously come into this industry and this job without that real this is how you do it mindset. So you've gone, I'll give that a go and I'll try that and it makes sense. And what has been the value of, like, if you could, I don't need like the financial value. Mm. I mean, if you can put a monetary value on it, great. But how would you describe the value of that podcast that you've built?
It's difficult, right? It's difficult to measure ROI on that. I think, as I said, the actual door opening and conversations with clients that we've then gone on to work with, that's sort of easy enough to measure. I'm not one for breaking down stats like that, so I don't have those numbers to hand. But the brand awareness in terms of Harriet Brown or myself, but Harriet Brown more so, has been like through the roof on it. I think like the touch points, and that doesn't necessarily reflect in number of downloads. Like I'm not looking at how many people are actually downloading this and listening to it, which wouldn't. It's not breaking any box office records, but it's the number of people that have come up or have mentioned to the consultants, oh, you're the guy, you've got the podcast Lessons I Learned in Law. Yeah. Then it's been invaluable on that front. It's given a great platform.
You don't need everyone to listen. And you've got to remember, if you get a group of people that listen regularly, like, that's so valuable. It's nuts. Mm. It's actually mental. And then you decided to do the boot camp with us, right? Yeah. So what made you then think about LinkedIn as being a channel that you should invest more time and effort on?
LinkedIn's always been my go-to since getting into recruitment, and a bit of a journey from my front on putting yourself out there and sharing. I'm not a big user of social media outside of LinkedIn. Like in my personal life, I don't post on Instagram or anything around that. But yeah, seeing the value in that from when I first got into recruitment, what I've always found challenging is implementing that across the wider team and how to encourage people within the team to find their voice on that platform, what they should be sharing. So it's been a little bit of internally, right, we're trying to do it and encourage it. And then, like, actually, what we need is a blueprint and some, like cajoling along, but also encouragement around what it is you should be doing and posting and what gets the results. So that was the and I've obviously followed, as I said, in terms of listening to the podcast, like followed your guys' work. And
how would you describe like the impact of learning that blueprint and putting that into practice?
It's been great. Like the follow-ups have been fantastic, and the team have really enjoyed it. So I think for the most part everyone's taken to it and building the habit. So it's been good. And feedback from everyone in terms of the investment in the team and doing that. And it's something that differentiates from other recruiters in our space.
100%. It's not an overnight fix either. Like you say, my business is about working with you guys on the long term, because we know things are going to change, and you know, people have good days and bad days, and it's that consistent communication and making sure you know what you're doing. But I've been really proud to see what you've done. And I think, like you say, there's so many things you didn't do before. And I think it's partly why you have taken to so many new things and you're just getting on with it. And you even said you're not a natural. You know, if I put myself, probably I'm on a 9 or a 10 in terms of I'm out there and I don't mind sharing. You almost don't want to give yourself a compliment. You'll almost like caveat the, you're about to say something good and you're like, I can see you're almost a bit uncomfortable talking about yourself at times. So to step out of your comfort zone and do these things, I think it's incredible, mate. And there's actually more people like that in our sector than I realized. I thought recruiters were just all extroverts, but they're not. Like there's a complete mixed bag of people.
Yeah,
and they can do it in a different way. Mm-hmm. You know, I think everyone still needs to build relationships. Yeah. Everyone still needs to be able to, you know, nurture people at scale. Like you're limited if you're just doing it on the phone. Like, that's how I look at it.
Yeah, that's it. It's been famous. It's been famous within the niche that you do, and being present and being front of mind, and people knowing what you do. So the value's there, and it's not looking for immediate. It's like anyone going into and doing that and taking that type of approach, if you're looking for an immediate win, like your head's in the wrong space. I think you have to. It's part of the overall like being the go-to. Like our goal is to be the go-to for in-house recruitment, and that's client and candidate relationships and providing fulfilling careers for lawyers, right? So it's to build up that narrative and build up credibility in that space.
That's like one of them like destination targets that you might you'll never know if you're there, but you can always go for it. You're always on the right journey. If you always know where you're going. I love that. Talk us through this change then. So you've gone from London, Southeast London, busy, you know, post-COVID stress, you're doing all these different things, you're building the team now, you've decided to go to Amsterdam. Yeah. Talk us through that change.
So Europe's always been somewhere that we've serviced through referrals almost, or clients that we've worked with in the UK. So there's always been a big draw. There's huge market over here, both in the Netherlands, but in like the DACH region and Switzerland. So it's something that's been on the horizon. Like as you said, I've not got that management experience and building the team. So 2022, I think I started looking at the idea of bringing someone in to give a structure, give the training, manage the team, which again I'm happy to say is not my strength. The day-to-day management of recruiters and giving that guidance. I think halfway through that year, I was energy levels quite low a lot of the time, managing that point, maybe nine people, all direct reports, because there was zero structure and management responsibilities elsewhere. Found that my days were just lost on dealing with things, and you came to the end of the day and you hadn't. It felt like I hadn't ticked anything off the list that I was planning to do. So I made that decision to bring someone in. Spoke to a few people in the market that had like legal recruitment experience, and sort of feedback, like really softly, but feedback was like, well, you're there, like you're that brand that's going to be a bit of an odd dynamic with yourself there. So that got me thinking, like opening a new office. That early stages and the ground up building of brand, which effectively is what we're doing in Europe, was exciting. And I thought the job's going to be a hell of a lot more interesting for someone to have that autonomy to be the managing director in the UK. So, and then my wife still works, is amazing. She's European General Counsel for Patagonia. So she applied for that job, and then like that was in Amsterdam. So all lined up, like end of, when would that have been? What year have been? 2024, 2022, end of that year. And it was like, right, this is meant to be happening. Let's go for it. And then kickstarted a search for a managing director, lined up the move with school terms, like mid half term. We moved over around about that time last year, to coincide with my wife starting work. And then James, our managing director, joined in June, which has been amazing. And his remit has been build that structure, build the team, go after new market.
That's got to be one of the hardest jobs to find in recruitment. Someone who wants to come in and take over a business.
Yeah. I had in mind what I was looking for. James's background, so he was at Faden for 12 or 13 years, and grew one of their divisions, or was part of the growth in one of their divisions from like 3 to I don't know, he knows the numbers, but a big brand within Faden. Yeah. Yeah, put in structure, managing teams of sort of 50, 60 people and grown teams through that model. So that was the type of background, but culturally coming into a smaller business and like rolling his sleeves up and being involved in the type of matters that go with being in a much smaller.
Did he have any legal recruitment?
No, zero. But that was, I think it's part of the attraction. I think there's great people within this space, but you at the senior end, you've got your own thing, you've got your own brand, and for me, that was how that could fit. I wasn't entirely sure. We also have a head of community, Emma, who's so well known within the sector that we work within. So she was at one of the big publishers within the legal field, and has relationships at general counsel and CLO level across the board. So she has her own unique brand as well, which adds really well. And from a marketing,
what does she actually do then?
She is an absolute rock star. So she is like. The community side, again, it's a bit of a buzzword, I think, but it's marketing in its traditional sense. But for me, it all goes back to that giving back. So her background was in events at the lawyer. So she was responsible for getting general counsels along to their sponsored events. We run our own events programs throughout the year. So she's continually hosting roundtables, like WhatsApp groups. So if there's a niche within the legal space, then she spots it. She'll bring people together that have similar challenges. Working in house as a lawyer, it's quite lonely because you're in the minority within your business and servicing whatever the needs are. There's always someone that's got a very similar challenge that you've faced, probably in another similar business, similar size company. So bringing those people together and giving them an opportunity to connect, then that's her. She's there, like, and there's very much like her role really needs to be whiter than white. So away from recruitment, there's no like sales funnel into her. It's not almost like a Chinese wall effectively between community and then. But for brand boosting and brand awareness for Heriot Brown, it's like, again, for me, it's a no-brainer as to how it sits and the impact again that it has.
She doesn't do any recruit. Does she flick leads across though when she finds them and stuff? Or is it for the recruiters to join the event?
Join the events and go along to the events and build the relationships. And like if anyone asks, Emma, do you know or can you help with this? Then a lead will come across. But again, creating a safe space for people to talk and our value as recruiters, if there's always going to be people finding jobs through their network. We can't, like, that's there. LinkedIn is there for that. If we lose out on a small percentage or a fraction of jobs in the market because someone knows someone from Emma's network, then you win some, you lose some. The actual ripple effect of having that community set up and having the network there, it's net positive. So
I think what's incredible is you've got a non-billing but client-facing external role, which is very rare. Like, you don't see that in big recruitment firms, never mind the smaller end of the market. Where did you come up with that idea? Did someone else... Was that just an idea you had, or did you just come across her? And
I met I met Emma. We sponsored events, right? So we sponsored the lawyer. The lawyer runs a gym. It used to be in somewhere in Spain, and I went along to that. We sponsored that, paid whatever your dues are as an agency to be there. And amongst law firms that are sponsoring it and these legal tech providers that I mentioned. And Emma was the hostess with the mostess in this environment, like knew everyone in that room. And this was when it was just me and Andrew. I was like, God, if ever she's wanting to leave the lawyer, like I'm hiring her, I'll find a job, whatever it is. We'll create something that works for her. I don't think she knows, like, that point, I tell her every day, but I don't think she knew at that point in time how good she was and how she, like, these relationships that she had. Kept in touch with her over the years. And then during lockdown, like, we were coming out of lockdown, we were starting, I was like, right, we need a big event once this Boris Johnson gets his head around the lockdown restrictions. Let's do a Burns night, which is like a Scottish tradition. Yeah. We'll do that in London. Hired this venue, and I got Emma's input when she was working at the lawyer. I was like, how are we going to do this, run this event? And then got wind that she was actually thinking about leaving. I was like, come here. What do you want? What job can we create? What would it look like?
What's the perfect job?
So that was finding, again, when she started, I was like, this is what your job description looks like just now. That's, you can rip that up in 6 months. It's going to be different. Like, it'll grow arms and legs. And So again, that was a real following gut feel. Malcolm that I mentioned earlier at Skills Alliance, the guy, he was like, you're mad hiring. I don't see how that's going to work, but it's definitely worked out.
Mate, it sounds epic. So you're now in Europe, you're building out that proposition, you've got a really solid structure in the UK, we've got an MD. What is the future? Like, what's next?
So growing out the European business is really the plan for this year. James's background is in like both the UK and the US. So we're set going through the process of setting up and growing out the US, and that's real sort of exciting future expansion in that market. Other sectors or other industries that are linked to the legal profession. So where it reports into a lawyer, compliance, company secretarial work, risk, governance, policy, those types of areas, there's real sort of growth potential. I don't have any headcount target or like real revenue numbers. I think mentioned before we came on there, this year is really the first year that I've sat down at the start of the year and properly budgeted for what we want to achieve this year, just so we can pat ourselves on the back, hopefully at the end of the year, or we can keep a track. But that's the growth plan for the recruitment side of things. Trying to innovate around the community side is really what gets me excited the most, and like the additional stuff that we can add value to around that. So one of our clients' biggest challenges is, We don't have budget to use you guys. We'd love to, but we're going to have to run it directly. But they don't always have an idea. They post a job, they reshare a job on LinkedIn. And then the actual inbound interest isn't quite there. So we're pulling together workshops and developing how can we support our clients to attract talent directly, and educating partly off the back of Hawkshow and how you use and engage with people online. So that's in the pipe.
Mate, such a modern, fresh approach to a business that almost happened by accident, I think is just incredible. That's how I look at it. I think it's incredible. I think you should be proud of yourself. And like you say, you said before the show, you know, there's been so many on the show, and I'm like, there's some big agency. I mean, what I love about this sector is people can build a business their own way. Everyone does it. Everyone skins this cat slightly differently. There'll be so many things people can learn from this episode and ideas. And I can already feel people's minds ticking over as they're listening, going, I could do that. I'll think about that. You know. So thanks so much for giving us your time.
Yeah, thank you.
Especially so close to having a third child.
Thanks for the opportunity. We're two weeks overdue, the first two. So we're thinking it's going to be the same. So it's going to be into May.
I was 10 days. I was 10 days when I, and that is a stressful 10 days. So, mate, I wish you all the best for that. If anyone does want to reach out to you and just pick your brains on this community-led recruitment or anything else, then is it okay just to drop you a note on LinkedIn?
Yeah, please drop me a DM. That would be great.
Mate, legend. Right. Thanks so much. We'll get you back on in a year or so and see how things are progressing.
Okay? All right. Cheers, mate. Thank you.
Thank you as always for listening to today's show. I truly hope that you got value from it. Honestly, it's the only reason I take time every week to ensure that my audience, you guys, future and existing recruitment owners, you're learning from each other to make this industry that I love so much stronger. And today's episode is brought to you by my business, Hawkshow. I'm the CEO and founder, and we're on a mission to help brand recruitment agencies and their people better. I want to help people have the tools to stand out in the most competitive markets in the world. We're currently working with over 350 recruitment agencies and 5,000 of their consultants right now, helping them to build their personal brands, to consistently win more business, attract talent, and just become that go-to recruiter in the market. Now, we do have a huge coaching program, but a lot of people don't know we also manage the brands of a lot of founders and we can do the rebrand of that company organizational piece as well. So if your recruitment agency either needs help to look and sound exactly how you want it to, or your leadership and consultant level need to get out there and drive more traffic back to that website, to the business, and start using LinkedIn to generate more revenue, then you should definitely be reaching out to us. If that sounds of interest, please do visit www.hoxhillmedia.com or drop me, Sean, a personal message on LinkedIn. I love hearing from RAG listeners. I would love to talk to you. Look forward to it. So I'll see you again next week with another episode. Catch you soon.